SBS தமிழ்.
Greetings, Annalene Padayachi. Did I say that right?
You did say that correct.
Thank you. Before we embark on talking about gut health, let's talk a little bit about you.
Okay.
Can you brief our audience on your background, please?
Okay. Well, I was born in South Africa. My first name is actually French. My surname is Tamil. My father's name, he is Ranganathan Padayachi. My mom is Morganaige Padayachi. But I think I'm third generation born South African. My great grandfather, however many generations back, was part of the Indians that were taken by the British to colonize the whole world. And so, yeah, that's how they ended up in South Africa. So, yes, I do eat curry and I can eat with my hands. I actually do know how to make curry. I'm not very good at making roti. That's mum's department. I can't understand any Tamil at all.
So, you don't speak at home?
No. So, my parents, is ironic because they're born in South Africa. My grandmother, both of them, my mum's mum and my dad's mum, are very fluent in Tamil. They can read it, write it. My grandfather could read and write Sanskrit. But because when my parents were born, it was during that apartheid era. And so maintaining your mother tongue was looked down upon. Mm-hmm. So their parents pushed them to learn English and Afrikaans because that's what they needed to pass in school. So my parents can understand Tamil, but they can't actually speak it. So if you're talking,
they didn't pass it on to you.
No, so I can't understand anything.
You said your name is French.
My first name's French, yeah.
Yeah, so where did that come from?
Well, I'm named, my grandmother, my dad's mom, her name is Mani Kamal, but she has an English name as well, which is Hannah. And so, because I'm the firstborn grandchild, she wanted me to be named after her. So, they called me Annalene, which is a derivative of Hannah.
I also read that your mother is a cancer survivor.
Correct.
Are you comfortable sharing that story with us?
Yeah. So, my mom was diagnosed with an incurable brain tumor in 1989. We just migrated to Australia in 1988. So, my parents came out to Australia because of apartheid. And so, yeah, they came out here and in 1989... my mom was diagnosed with this brain tumor. She had severe pains, really bad headaches. And my dad came home one day from work and he found her semi-conscious, unable to move and do stuff for herself. So he took her to hospital and after 10 days, they discovered a 1.5 centimeter in diameter brain tumor that had the same density as bone. So it wasn't like your normal cancer that you can easily siphon out or treat with chemotherapy. This one had the same density as bone and it was the shape of a donut. So if you look at a donut, it's got the hole in the middle. So mum had brain cells trapped on the inside that was not getting any blood to it, which caused her to be in incredible pain and she'd get paralyzed on the left side of her body. And then around it, as the brain tumor grew, it inflamed the brain. So that caused her to have a lot of pain. So the only options they gave her were operation. And if they did the operation, it entailed physically removing her skull, removing part of her brain, and then actually pulling this tumor out. And in doing so, she'd lose whatever brain was trapped on the inside of bone tumor, and then put the brain back, and then put the skull back. No one in medical history has survived that type of brain tumor, and you can understand why. It's quite invasive. There wasn't any medication that they could give her to stop the growth. They could only give her medication to make her feel less pain, sedate her. That option, and if she did the operation, she had a 50% chance of dying in theater. And if she survived the operation, she would be a vegetable because she'd lose part of her brain. She wouldn't know who we were and she would die within 2 years anyway. If she chose to not have the operation, she would become a vegetable progressively within 2 years and then die after that time as well. And that was pretty, I think for my parents, it was very shocking to hear that news. Like, we're new migrants in Australia. My mom was only in her late 20s. I was 6 and a half at the time. My brother was just over a year old and just kind of shocked their world. And mom decided to make the decision to not have the operation. She wanted to live for as long as she possibly could. And I'll be honest, like, I was a kid growing up during that. It was hard, you know, as a child, I didn't know that my mother was dying. All I knew, she was sick and I wasn't allowed to touch her. There were times we couldn't make any noise. My brother and I would just sit on the floor and look at her because she'd just be lying in bed paralyzed. And we couldn't understand why we weren't allowed to touch her or jump on the bed. All we knew is that mom's sick and you can't touch her. And I think that was probably more challenging for my parents than for us. We just, kids, you just adjust. But parents know what's really going on. And yeah, my mom and dad put their faith in God, and literally 2 years to the day, she's been healed. And my parents have the medical proof to show that. She was certified a miracle by the radiologists in Melbourne. They've got the CAT scans from 1989 and all of her medical history. And then they've got these CAT scans from 1991, which shows perfect brain cells, no damaged brain cells. The chief radiologist in Melbourne actually compared the scans between 89 and 91, because if you have an identical twin that they actually have to scar one of you to tell them apart, your brain pattern and your bone pattern will not be the same. So you might look exactly the same on the outside, but your brain pattern and your bone pattern will be different. Mm. And so they compared my mom's brain pattern and bone pattern from 1989 to 1991, and they concluded that it was not even out by 0.1 of a millimeter. It's exactly the same person, just where this brain tumor has gone and all this damaged brain. They've got no idea.
When you say bone pattern,
your skeletal bone, your bone pattern, so the width and the size of your bone, not even out by 0.1 of a millimeter. And so, yeah, she was confirmed, and that was like 1991. She's still alive. She ended up having another child afterwards. My parents live in Brisbane. So, yeah, this year in September will be, as mom says it, it's her 27th birthday. She's been given an extra 27 years of life. Yeah, sometimes I, you know, think about it, and especially in my line of work, I do get into the cancer research side of things. You know, medical science is great, and I believe in it, and I believe in the science of it, and I do it myself. But yeah, there's times where you just can't explain why things happen or why things get divine intervention, and faith definitely is that key thing, I guess, for us. Yeah.
Is what your mother went through that made you become who you are?
I think when I was younger, I didn't fully understand the depths of what my mom had gone through. And I saw all the CAT scans, and I was just nearly 9 when she got healed. And it was just so weird, like, you know, growing, like living in this bubble for nearly 18 months where we had to be silent. And then now we're allowed to like make noise and be normal kids. It was just really weird to adjust to being like that. I've always liked food. Science is something I go to work at. It's not like, you know, I'm one of those people who just gets chemistry just like that. I've got to work at it. But when it comes to food and the application of science and biology and physics and chemistry with regards to human health, it makes complete sense to me. But when I was doing my undergrad degree, I had to do a lot of work with human anatomy and dissecting brains and things like that. And then it started to make a bigger impact on my life, because I was seeing an actual cadaver and I'm dissecting this brain, and this was a real person. And now it's starting to hit me, like, this could be my mom. This was like what was going on in her head. Yeah, I did delve a bit more deeper into that with my academics, but I never thought I would end up going down the direction of looking at how food, what it actually does in the human body to prevent diseases. Like, as a nutritionist, you know, people need to eat healthy stuff and lots of plant-based foods and lots of different unprocessed foods. And if we can get that message out, that's fantastic. But my research is one step back from that. It's actually understanding, how does fruit and vegetables, what is it in this purple carrot? How does dietary fiber actually work?
I didn't realize that what you're eating is a purple carrot.
Yeah, here you go. It's a purple carrot.
would you call that a mix between beetroot and carrot?
Or no, that is actually the original carrot. Carrots were originally purple. They were not orange. And you still get them in parts of India. They're quite common, especially northern India. Purple carrots are the thing over there. So what happened is, I think it was back in the 1600s, a farmer in Austria started noticing his purple carrots showing some of these orangey yellow speckles. And he decided, let me see, I'll let them grow and see what happens. And they became more and more orange. And he sold them to the Dutch royal family. And because, you know, the Netherlands like orange everything, they made them more popular and spread them with the whole world. And that's why orange carrots are the most popular carrot. But your original carrot is actually purple.
Interesting. I didn't know that. You did your bachelor's and master's and your PhD in Australia.
I did a bachelor's degree in food science and nutrition, mm-hmm. and then I did honors majoring in public health nutrition. I did not do a master's degree. I went and worked in the food industry after that because even though I was a nutritionist and I'm also a food scientist, I wanted to understand why is it that nutritionists work with consumers? The food industry works for consumers. It just seems that the two of them don't seem to work together a whole lot. They do.
There's a disconnect, yes.
Yeah, there's, you know, interrelationship now between them, but back then, not really. So I worked in the food industry for a while. And while I was in the food industry trying to understand all of the logistics of the food supply and why we have the processed food industry that we do, there's a lot of validity in why we have the industry that we have. And it's highly motivated by consumer behavior. While I was doing that, I got offered a role to do a PhD with CSIRO and the University of Queensland. And so, yes, I went off and did that. And after that, I worked for Melbourne Uni as an academic for a while. And I'm still an associate academic with them. The reason why I got into this, I guess the background story is the reason why I got into this, totally did not expect it whatsoever, is I worked for a functional food company and we were producing all this juice. And there would be, you know, the bright orange is because of carotene. And then there's also all this pulp that's discarded. And the pulp was also orange. And so my thing was like, well, if there's carotene in the pulp and there's carotene in the juice, how much of the carotene is going in the pulp? And so I looked it up. I tried to find the answer. And strangely enough, I could not find any answer at all. And that's why I ended up doing a PhD on this area. And if we throw that pulp out, we're losing that. If we consume it, we're potentially feeding our gut bacteria, but that depends on how we've processed it. So that was like, oh my gosh, this is more complex than I thought. What I would love to do now is how do we use this fibrous material? Because it's produced in juice manufacturing, it's produced in souping. Can we create it into a functional ingredient? So can I use it to thicken yogurt or can I use it to thicken ice cream? So we're getting this fibrous benefit from a traditionally unhealthy food. Now we're actually improving its nutritional properties and we're also decreasing waste at the same time.
The reason why I asked is anyone who's listening to this, who is interested in taking up a career in becoming a nutritionist or a food technologist, what would be your advice?
You know, there's a lot of dietitians out there. And that's something that I have not chosen, actively chosen to do. I did not want to be a clinical dietitian. They basically are generally based in hospitals or in private practice, and there's not enough jobs to go around. So now we're starting to see dietitians filter into the food industry because there's just not enough clinical positions out there. I would highly suggest for any young person considering a career, food is the best thing. And I'm probably very biased in saying that, but it really is. Like you've got biology, you've got human anatomy, you've got chemistry, you've got physics, you've got maths, you've got consumer behavior, you've got a whole range of different things. You've even got engineering, all chucked into the one product. There's no other product out there that has so much diversity. If you're a food scientist, you can work in any of those different arenas. If you get bored of working with chocolate, you can go work with red meat. If you get bored of red meat, you can go work with dairy products. It's the same underlying principles, but you're applying it to totally different things. And it's always fun. It's always evolving. And most importantly, everyone needs to eat. So you'll never be out of a job anywhere in the world. You're always going to be in demand. I'm very unusual in the sense that I am both a qualified food scientist. So I understand the science of food. So if you think about, for example, a sachet of microwavable quick oats or a chocolate bar, or a functional fruit juice product. I understand how the processing of that happens and how when we process it, what impact that has on the ingredients in terms of nutrition, but also in terms of shelf stability, food safety, quality control, all those sort of things. But then I'm also unique because I'm also a qualified human nutritionist, which is a very unusual combination to have both, which means I'm always in demand. And there's always someone who needs my expertise to cover both nutrition and food science at the same time. So I would totally recommend it. I love it. I've worked across every type of food product you can think of. It's always evolving. It's always changing. It's always fun. It's always dynamic. And if you think about it in terms of Australia, the food industry is our largest manufacturing industry. So it's, you know, it's on par with the mining sector. So in Australia, in terms of jobs, the food sector is really important. And it's not just about like creating a food product that someone gets to eat. It's about the engineering behind those machines and how we make that product. There's a great story of, you may have had it, the Streets Viennetta ice cream. It's that log. That was actually created by a mechanical engineer, not a food technologist. So how those ribbons take place, that's all about engineering. I had an ex-student who was doing civil engineering and he's always wanted to work in, you know, construction sites, but food opened a totally different arena to him and he's gone to China to work on one of the largest vertical farms in the world. So there is so much of opportunity. Food is not just about what you eat. It impacts all aspects of life.
The reason why we contacted you is to know more about the upcoming conference in which you're going to talk about gut health.
Mm-hmm.
Can you briefly tell us about the conference and what you're going to talk?
Okay, so it is part of the Sydney Science Festival. The Sydney Science Festival is run from, I think, the 8th of August thereabouts till about the 19th of August. And I'm doing a presentation on gut health. It's a workshop, so part of it will be a kombucha workshop with someone else and part of it will be me explaining all about our gut microbiota in really simple terms. Now, most people know or they're hearing the gut microbiota, gut microbes, your gut bugs, eating prebiotics, eating probiotics, having kombucha or yogurt or all these different things. It's about feeding these gut bugs, but what actually are gut bugs? So that's what my presentation will be on, about the bacteria, the beneficial bacteria that actually live in our colon. So you've got your, basically when you eat food, if you imagine it, you've got your mouth. That's where digestion starts. When you start chewing it up, it goes down your esophagus into your stomach. It's churned around, broken down by the acid, and then it goes into your small intestine where nutrients are absorbed, and whatever's not absorbed ends up in your colon. And that's where your bacteria live, and they ferment whatever comes in there and makes it easy to pass it out of our body. But what they ferment actually affects both their health, actually affects the type of bacteria that we grow. It affects the numbers of bacteria. And when the bacteria are fermenting whatever comes in there, so it could be like dietary fiber, bits of meat that we haven't fully processed or digested and absorbed, whatever it is, whatever ends up in that colon, when these bacteria are fermenting it, they actually produce byproducts. And those byproducts are really, really, really healthy and important, or they can be. Some can be very detrimental and unhealthy for our colon, and some can be really healthy and beneficial. The gut health is, I guess you could say, it's kind of like a big black hole because we don't know as much about it as we do about other parts of the human body. Research in the gut microbiota is evolving and changing rapidly as we're starting to understand these different types of bacteria. And every single person has got their own unique strains as well. So how does the food we eat is, you know, eating this carrot, chomping it up, chewing it in my mouth versus if I make it into a smoothie or into juice or if I roast it, does heating it, does that actually affect how the fiber that reaches my bacteria, is that going to have a beneficial or a negative impact on them? So particle size is really important. So if you think about, if you take that carrot, you take a bite into it, chew it up, and just before you swallow it, spit it back out, and then you measure the particle size with a ruler. For most people, the size of the chewed up food is usually between 5 to 7 millimeters in size. But an individual cell, now it's a bit hard to see if you cut the carrot and you do a cross section, you'll see teeny tiny circles under a microscope. And if you actually look at that, they're about 100 microns in size. So they're extremely small.
Mm-hmm.
So if we've got something that's about 7 millimeters in size, if you think about it, you've chewed up this carrot, what you swallow is approximately 7 millimeters in size. You've got heaps and heaps and heaps and heaps and heaps of those intact cells in there. And the thing is that the nutrients, the antioxidants, are actually trapped on the inside of those cells. So unless they can open up and get out somehow or the other, they're going to be trapped inside that intact cell. Mm. So that means they go through your small intestine and they end up in your colon. And so your bacteria can now ferment it. So if it's a small, tiny cell, it'll ferment it. If it's a big chunk, it will ferment it. But if it's a big chunk, it will ferment it, but to a different degree, different amount of fermentation will take place. So some nutrients may be released, different types of these byproducts will be produced. The more harder the bacteria have to work, the more of the beneficial byproducts it produces. So that's a good thing. But on the flip side of the coin is, if it's a big whole intact cell or whole clump of cells, it's harder for these antioxidants to be released. So if it's smaller, it doesn't take as much effort for the bacteria to ferment, but they can open the cell up. So what's the key thing is having your raw carrot is good. Eating that carrot is good, but also having probably a bowl of soup or a smoothie is also good at the same time. Having clarified juice, however, totally different because now we've removed all of that good fibrous material out.
You mentioned kombucha.
Kombucha, yeah.
What is that? Can you explain a little bit on that?
Kombucha, basically, it's a type of fermented drink. So it can be juice or it can be
made from any fruit?
Yeah, any type of fruit juice or even tea or even plain water. And so they put bacteria in it and allow it to ferment. Very simplistic. That's what kombucha is. Special types of bacteria will allow the liquid to ferment and it grows. So the bacteria grows. And so you drink it and basically you're drinking a shot of live bacteria.
This talk that you are giving, is that open to public?
It is open to public, yeah.
And when is that?
It's on the 18th. On the 18th of August between 1 and 2:30 p.m.
If anyone is interested, what do they have to do to get to your talk?
Go on to the Sydney Science Festival. And they've got a whole list of all the different events. So you can just scroll down, see what is there and click on it and it will have all the details on how to attend. Yeah.
What would be your next initiative or research or study on?
My next thing that I would love to study on and research in a bit more detail. So these carrots, I've continued to study them and we've fed them to pigs. So the other thing that I like researching is food fraud and how packaging actually minimizes food fraud. I know that sounds a bit crazy, but food fraud is a big issue. So looking at the different types of packaging materials and how that actually prevents or controls consumer behavior, but also how that prevents and controls fraudulent behavior, like getting that chunk of meat or fish or wine out of the bottle and putting inferior quality or fake product into that.
You just intrigued my interest in purple carrots.
Yeah.
Where can I get them?
So these purple carrots, I actually bought it from the Sydney market, but you do get them occasionally in Woolies and Coles. In Coles, I think they're called purplets. That's how they market it. And it's in this little pack called purplets. But occasionally you get them in Woolworths as well. They are seasonal. They don't grow as long during the year as orange carrots do. But I pick them up from, the Sydney markets.
Okay. Sometimes you have these fads like goji beer a few years ago. Now that's gone away or the fad is not there anymore.
Yeah.
Is that real or is that when some people realize something has got real nutritional values, they promote it and then it becomes a fad and then it dies off after some time?
Yeah, that is true. Yeah. That's definitely true. Goji berries were a big thing back in the early to mid 2000s. And then, they're still around, but they've kind of tapered off as new things evolve. I think everyone is always looking for the magic bullet. And definitely at the moment, turmeric is the buzz thing. So everybody's eating turmeric lattes, turmeric in this, turmeric in that. The truth is you cannot take a magic bullet if you've got a generally unhealthy diet. If your diet is 90%, 80%, 75%, 50% even filled with junk, taking a turmeric latte is really not going to do a whole lot for you. But I think a lot of the reasoning behind these fads, it is based on, looking at epidemiological evidence, looking at populations that have eaten it for a long time. And I look at my grandma and, she's in her 80s and she's always used turmeric in dal. And I'm like, why do you put turmeric in it? And she's, because my mother told me to. I'm like, okay, so why'd she do it? I don't know. You just do. It makes the curry yellow. I'm like, okay, cool. Makes the curry yellow. How often do you eat dal? And she ate every day. I'm like, oh, okay, every single day you eat dal. So every single day, for as long as she knows, she's been eating dal as part of her meals.
With turmeric.
And it's got turmeric in it. Mm. So she's had this dose of turmeric her whole life. And before she was even born, her mother was eating turmeric in dal as well. So you've got this impact of the small dose, but for a very long period of time. And she doesn't have diabetes or any chronic health conditions. She's pretty healthy. And so
she doesn't need turmeric latte.
No, not at all. And so she actually asked me that. She's like, people are telling me I need to take turmeric tablets. I'm like, yeah, but eat turmeric every single day in your dal. You don't need to take a tablet. But turmeric is becoming much more trendy because when you look at population groups like in India, they don't seem to have as much chronic health conditions as we do in the Western world. However, that is starting to change as they're starting to move to a much more processed diet. Mm. Yeah.
Well, Annalene, thank you very much for coming to the studio and giving us the opportunity to talk to you and the wisdom that you shared.
You're welcome. Anytime.
இதை போன்ற இன்னும் பல நிகழ்ச்சிகளை செவிமடுக்க sbs.com.au/tamil